Here we go, lecture 8. Okay, now that came out Ruth level, I would say. This is, if I can just keep it like this. Okay, so this will be, last time we discussed spontaneous symmetry breaking. In general, you might say, we met the Higgs mechanism and the Goldstone theorem. And now we want to apply it to the standard model. Okay, that's our job for today. And in fact, we may not finish the fermionic part of the standard model, the symmetry breaking, because that has its own subtleties, but we'll get through the bosons. Okay, so let's do it. So let's start with the bosonic part of the standard model Lagrangian. Okay, so we have, as usual, our kinetic terms for the spin one fields. And the other bosonic line here are the terms for the scalar fields. Kinetic term for the Higgs and the potential for the Higgs field. Okay, and then there's plus two more lines of fermions, which I'm not going to write at the moment. Okay, now before, I'm just going to do one change of notation minor change of notation to match more standard convention here. So if you look at these guys, if you look at these first two kinetic terms, you know, so as we met earlier, this guy, let's say, is a 3x3 matrix, but I can decompose it in a basis of 3x3 matrices, generators of SU3, these are the so-called Gell-Mann matrices, times 8 real fields, which are the 8 gluon fields. In other words, A runs from 1 to 8 here. Okay, now I have been normalizing things so far in what you might call the, well, what would be naturally the canonical convention, which would be to take lambda A, lambda B, and normalize them so that their trace is, so that they're orthonormal in the sense that their trace is 0 if A is not equal to B, and 1 if A is equal to B. So if you normalize them like that, then, well, okay, the trace comes in here, hits a product of two. Imagine we expand both of these g mu nus. One is g mu nu A times lambda A, and the other one is g mu nu B times lambda B. The trace hits the lambdas, turns it into delta AB, and then we would rewrite this thing as, without the trace, it's just minus a quarter g mu nu A, g mu nu A, summed over A. And same thing for that guy. Okay, now, in this lecture, we will be following more conventional notation for the standard model, for SU2 in particular, where you take this to be normalized like that. In which case, if we want to still have the minus 1/4 after we evaluate the traces, we have to multiply the coefficient here. Sorry, I said this backwards. Excuse me. The convention we will take now to match is that the trace of a product is equal to 1/2 if they're the same two matrices, in which case I have to multiply the coefficient here by 2 if I want to then get the same answer after I evaluate the trace. Okay, so this sometimes for that reason is the convention you'll see more in the standard model, and it's the one that I will use henceforth. You know, I like the other one because it emphasized the parallelism with that guy, but now this one has the advantage that when we like I say, when we expand these things in terms of their components, which is the way we'll want to look at them in this lecture, then this will become minus 1 quarter g mu nu a times g mu nu a. Okay, and ditto. I'll just move the a's up and down to get them out of the way. Okay, so now these fields just again are real four vectors. They're not matrices anymore, but we're summing. There's a sum of eight. There's g mu nu 1 times g mu nu 1 plus g mu nu 2, g mu nu 2, etc. There's 8 there, 3 there, and 1 there. Okay. And then again, plus fermionic terms, we're going to ignore, at least for the first part of the lecture. Okay, and so far the writing continues to be Ruth level, I would say. I mean, not Ruth level, but you know, better than my average. Okay, great. So now, you know, just like last time, we want to look for the vacua of the standard model. So we want to look for the lowest energy solutions of the equations of motion. And, you know, the story is just the same as last time. We're going to look for the solutions that minimize this potential. Well, that's easy. I mean, we already did it last time, but just to be clear that there's no change. I mean, last time we were dealing with a single scalar field. Now this is H is now a doublet of two complex scalar fields, but nothing changes. The point is the potential you can see only depends on this real number, on this real valued quantity, H dagger H. Just appears here and here's and squared over here. So, you know, if we just call that X, we're just trying to minimize some function. The function only depends on this sort of radial variable X. And we're trying to find where that's a minimum. And so if we have m squared x minus lambda over 4 x squared, and we want to minimize that, well, we just take the derivative. And the minimum is where that is equal to 0. So we have that, in other words, just like we found before, that h dagger h is minimized, the potential is minimized when h dagger h is equal to 2m squared over lambda. Okay, and actually let's write h in terms of its real components to see things a little bit more clearly. So this is two complex numbers, so let's write it as four real fields, chi 1 plus I chi 2 on the top, and chi 3 plus I chi 4 on the bottom. So if we plug this into that expression, then this says that chi 1 squared plus chi 2 squared plus chi 3 squared plus chi 4 squared is equal to 4 m squared over lambda, because we pick up a 1 half that I've just moved over to the other side. Okay, and so this is just the equation for a sphere in four dimensions. So if we, you know, we have some four-dimensional space here. Of which I can only draw three, but so there's, you know, there's chi 1, chi 2, chi 3, and chi 4 are the four field directions. Okay, and this says that there's some sphere. Of radius 2m over the square root of lambda, on which the potential is minimized in field space. Okay, and so in particular, this is a so again, let's imagine now that we have to just pick one of these guys to be the Vev. So we pick some point here. And in particular, let's pick, I drew it wrong here. What I really want to pick is the point where everyone is zero except for chi 3. So let me change the labels here. Chi 3, set to chi 2. So we'll write the Vev as the particular Vev chosen by nature. We'll choose to be the case where it's zero on top and then a real number on the bottom, real number V. Or now it's V squared that is equal to this. Okay, and so you know, one way to count, so if this was if what we were spontaneously breaking here was a global symmetry, if SU3 times SU2 times U1 was a global symmetry, then we could ask, well, how many Goldstone bosons do we expect? And one way to count it is just to say, well, how many flat directions are there in the potential? I expect, as I move away from this point, if I imagine moving in field space, how many different ways are there to move? Well, we have four variables subject to one constraint, so this defines a three-dimensional manifold, the three sphere. So there's three flat directions. I mean, I can only draw two here, this one and this one, but there's a third one. And so we expect, on that ground, three Goldstone bosons. Okay, if we were breaking a spontaneous, if we were breaking a global symmetry. Okay, and then last time we were saying that there is another way to formally count that, which we should also do because it clarifies some things. So the other way to count that number is to say, okay, so let V be the full Lie algebra of symmetry generators of the theory. So in the case of the standard model, this would be SU3. The group is SU3 times SU3, SU2 times U1. And so the Lie algebra is, this is a vector space. This is the Lie algebra of SU3 and then plus direct sum with Lie algebra of SU2, direct sum, Lie algebra for U1. Okay, and so this, remember this is the number of independent 3x3 unitary matrices. This is the group, SU3 is the group of 3x3 unitary matrices with determinant 1, which is e to the I Hermitian traceless matrices. How many Hermitian traceless matrices are there? Well, there's n squared minus 1, where this is n. So 3 squared minus 1 is 8 in this case. So there's 8 of those. These are the 8, again, these are the 8 Gell-Mann matrices, the generators of SU3. There's here 2 squared minus 1 is 3. 3 of those. These are the 3 generators of SU2. These are the Pauli matrices, basically. Okay, we'll call them Ti. We'll get... And then U1. Well, there's just one generator of U1. U1 is just the circle, this circle of phases in the complex plane. We'll call this generator Y for hypercharge. For some reason, that's the conventional name. Call it Y. Okay. So great. So that's the full vector space of the Lie algebra. And then we said that to analyze the pattern of spontaneous symmetry breaking, what we should look at next is find the subalgebra, the subspace of this vector space that annihilates the Vev. So, sorry. So just to be clear, this is the vacuum expectation value of V. So I'll this thing is just a constant everywhere in space. So this is not the field. We're going to expand about this in a minute and write the actual field, but this guy is just the vector. And so, again, what the next thing we want to do is look for the subspace of the Lie algebra. We want to look for the subgroup of the Lie group that acts trivially on the VEV, that doesn't move the VEV. Because why? You know, remember, the reason is that, well, we're going to now rewrite the field H. We're going to expand all the fields about their vacuum value now. We're going to rewrite them as their vacuum values plus something. Well, everybody's vacuum value is zero except for the Higgs field. So the only thing we're really going to rewrite is the Higgs field. But OK, so now when we do that, we're going to rewrite that as we're going to do some expansion where our previous Lagrangian was written in terms of H. We're going to rewrite it in terms of a new field, capital H, which is the deviation from the vacuum expectation value. And so now think about this new Lagrangian. Think about what the symmetries will look like when the new Lagrangian is equivalent to the old Lagrangian. It's just been written in new variables. So ultimately, it has to have all the same symmetries that the old Lagrangian had. But if I hand you a Lagrangian that's written in terms of capital H, it will look to you, if I look at the symmetries, so when I expand the Lagrangian in this form, now the terms in the Lagrangian will involve capital H, and some of the coefficients in front of those terms will involve this number V, appearing as a coefficient, just like a gauge coupling or a Yukawa coupling or a mass. It will just be appearing, it will look like it's just a constant in front of a term. But then, if we consider a symmetry that when it acts on this field, changes this constant, that will not look like a symmetry of the theory when it's written in terms of this field. I mean, in other words, normally when you talk about the symmetries of a Lagrangian, you mean symmetries that transform the fields while leaving the coupling constants alone. But if we have a symmetry that acts on this guy that changes, that acts non-trivially on this vacuum, on this constant vector, then when we've rewritten the Lagrangian in this form, it'll look like it's not a symmetry of the theory, because it'll look like it's a symmetry where I can't just change the fields in some way. I have to also transform the actual, you know, constant coupling constants in the Lagrangian. And normally we think of that as not being a symmetry. So in that sense, any generator that when acting on A, and any symmetry that when acting on H doesn't leave V alone will look like a broken symmetry in the other theory. So that's why we want to, by contrast, any symmetry that when it acts on H does leave this vector alone, does leave the VEV alone, will continue to look like a symmetry on the new theory. It'll continue to just look like a transformation of the fields themselves, which leaves the coupling constants alone. So that's why we want to check for the subspace W that leaves that vector alone. So let's think about what does. Well, remember that the way H transforms, if we looked at H's line, we had this table of the standard model SU3 times SU2 times U1. And I usually write all the fields here, but let's just focus on the Higgs field. So it transforms like a singlet under SU3. In other words, it doesn't transform under SU3. When you do an SU3 transformation on the rest of the fields, you just leave H alone. It transforms like a doublet under SU2, and it transforms with hypercharge plus a half. Okay, so first of all, trivially, all the eight generators of SU3 leave this guy alone. Let me say something more clearly. So, a group element that acts on H, when I say this guy leaves it alone, I mean a group element which is represented by the number 1, or the identity matrix, does nothing to H. So we're looking for those, but we're looking for them in terms of the Lie algebra. So in terms of the Lie algebra, we would write this as e to the I x, acting on H, And now if we ask what Lie algebra elements, what does the Lie algebra element X have to be in order for this thing to be evaluate to the identity matrix? Well, this thing would have to be the zero matrix. So, or this the action on this guy would have to, in order for this thing to do nothing to this, X has to be zero when acting on this, because e to the I zero is one. I mean, e to the zero is one. Okay, so we're looking for the Lie algebra elements, the subspace of this vector space, that we're looking for Lie algebra elements X that when they act on H, give zero. And so the first thing I'm saying is that all eight of the generators of SU3 do that, because they all have this property that they act as the identity matrix here on H, according to this table. And so they must act as e to the I times zero times H. Okay, so zero acting on H is zero. So these guys are all in W. And so the only thing we need to think about more carefully is, what about the remaining four generators here, these, the three TIs and the Y, which of those leave H invariant? Okay, well, so how do the how are these elements represented on H? Well, the fact that the hypercharge has charge 1/2 is saying that it acts like that under a U1 transformation e to the I alpha, that it acts on H. H transforms like e to the I alpha times 1/2 times H. So H transforms like this under U1. And so that's saying that the generator Y, when represented on H, is just 1/2 times the identity matrix. When it's acting on the two component vector H, that's what Y is. Okay, and now what about these guys? What are the generators of SU2 in the fundamental or two-dimensional representation of SU2? Well, they're just the Pauli sigma matrices. Okay, except if you take two Pauli sigma matrices and multiply them and take their trace, their trace will be 2. And so to get it to be a half, which their trace will be delta, will be 2 delta ij. It'll be 2 when they're the same and 0 when they're not the same. So because we are choosing this convention that we get a half there, these are not the correctly normalized generators. To get the correctly normalized generators for SU2, we will take 1/2 times the Pauli sigma matrices. Okay, in which case, now these things are properly normalized. Trace of Ti, Tj is 1/2 delta ij. And so just to remind you explicitly, because we'll use them in a minute, the Pauli sigma matrices are sigma 1 is like this. It's just ones on the off diagonal. Sigma 2 is minus I and plus I on the off diagonal. And sigma 3 is 1 and can the people over there not see this? Let me. And sigma 3 is 1 and minus 1 on the diagonal. Okay, so let's see if we can find a linear combination. Each of these generators separately, if we take each of these generators, the three TIs or Y, and separately act them on H, they don't vanish. But we want to ask, can we take a linear combination of those four generators that does vanish, or maybe more than one linear combination? If so, then those linear combinations will also lie in the subspace W that we're looking for. Okay, so let's take a general linear combination of those generators, alpha y plus beta beta I ti. So in other words, beta 1 times t1 plus beta 2 times t2, et cetera. Well, according to what we just said, this thing is 1 half times the identity matrix. So this looks like 1 half times 1, 1. Sorry, 1 half times alpha, alpha. And then beta 3 times t3 gives us plus beta 3 in the upper component and minus beta 3 down here. And then beta 1 times t1 gives us beta 1 and beta 1 here and here in the off-diagonal components. And beta 2 times t2 gives us minus I beta 2 and plus I beta 2. Okay, so now we want to act this. Now let's act this on our vacuum expectation value and demand that this be 0. Well, so if we evaluate this, that's, okay, sorry, I dropped the 1 over 2, but it doesn't, anyway. So we can rewrite this as 1 over 2 root 2, and then V, and the point is that when this vector acts on this guy, it only picks up these two pieces. So we have beta 1 minus I beta 2, and alpha minus beta 3. Okay, so in order for this to be 0, we see that it requires that beta 1 and beta 2 both vanish, because they're the real and imaginary parts of this complex number, which both have to vanish. And here we have two real numbers, which they don't have to separately vanish, they can cancel. So what we want is alpha is equal to beta 3. Or in other words, if we want a linear combination like this to annihilate the VEV, we have to take the combination where beta 1 and beta 2 are 0, and beta 3 is equal to alpha. So in other words, the combination which works, and which is called, the combination which works is alpha times y plus alpha times t3, which is otherwise known as alpha times the electric charge. So let's just erase the alphas. So the electric charge in our normalization here, this is 1 half the identity matrix. This is 1 half the third Pauli sigma matrix. So when we evaluate it here, the 1 half and the upper diagonals add to give 1 here. And the 1 half in the lower diagonal cancels the minus 1 half in the lower diagonal here. And so everything else is 0. And the electric charge generator looks like this. So our unbroken symmetry, the subalgebra of V, which annihilates H, consists of the 8 generators of SU3, and then the electric charge. Okay, so this is a 9-dimensional subspace, and these are the unbroken symmetries of the standard model, SU3 and U1 electric charge. So these, all the 8-gauge bosons contracted with this guy in the kinetic term, and the one more gauge boson here, which will be called the photon, corresponding to this generator, those are the 9-gauge bosons which remain massless even after spontaneous symmetry breaking. And then, on the other hand, we're supposed to look at the space V mod W now, the quotient space. Well, if we quotient this space by this subspace, the dimension of this guy is, you know, it has dimension 12 minus 9. 12 was the original dimension of V, 8 plus 3 plus 1, and then minus this 9, so this has dimension 3. And so, remember, according to our argument last time, this is supposed to be two things. This is supposed to tell us how many Goldstone bosons we would get if we had been breaking a global symmetry. Well, that's good. That matches our counting before. Previously, we just looked at our picture of the potential and said it was a 3-sphere, so there was, the vacuum manifold was a 3-sphere, so there were 3 flat directions in which to move. So this checks out. This is the number of Goldstone bosons. But now, because Instead, we're breaking a gauge symmetry. What happens instead is that we don't get any Goldstone bosons. Instead, each of these three former Goldstone bosons gets eaten by one of the three remaining generators here. We had the original 12 generators. We remove 9 of them. There are 3 left over. Each of those 3 guys eats a Goldstone boson and becomes massive. So this is the number of massive vector bosons that we expect to get in the standard model. Okay, so let's see how that actually works out in practice. Let's just calculate and see that that actually works. Yeah, I can't move 2 boards at a time. Okay, maybe this is a good place to take a break. What, anyone volunteering as to entertain us today? All right, yes, go for it.
It's a little bit mean to you, though.
Okay, that sounds entertaining for everybody except one of us. That sounds good.
It goes like, oh, Latham Boyle.
Latham.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, Latham Boyle. You are no Fred Hoyle. Your writing is not Ruth level. Your poems are disheveled. All you've taught is the standard model is the work of the devil.
Wow, that is good. Now, when I complained that yesterday's was not quite a limerick, that complaint is much more applicable to this one. But nevertheless, that was in a way good, and I in a way appreciate it. No, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. That's great. Fred Hoyle was crazy. I mean, he was a great guy. He was crazy. He also went crazier and crazier, which is something I aspire to do as well. Okay, so let's see. So, okay, great. Let's proceed to calculate now. Basically, we want to now plug in the expression for the VEV, and I like this reason. So our job now is we want to plug in this expression to the Lagrangian. Well, let me remind you. So we're taking the general expression for H and expanding it around the vacuum expectation value. So you might say, well, if we're looking at the general expression for H, why aren't there also real and imaginary components up here and another imaginary component down here? And the answer is that we went to so-called unitary gauge. We used our gauge freedom to simplify our life a little bit. So we used the fact that H transforms under SU2 to rotate at every point in space. We're going to take the two complex component vector over that point and rotate it to be a real vector with its only non-zero component in the lower side. Sorry, I'm just remembering the poem and belatedly enjoying it. Sorry. It's good that these are all being recorded, you know, because I don't know, I haven't been writing them down, but they're all on video. That's good. Okay, so let's plug it in. So to see what happens, well, let's look at the kinetic term. Let's look at this at what happens to this guy. So this is, again, in general, this would look like acting on our field. Okay, but now we want the appropriate representation for each of these. So since H transforms as a singlet under SU3, again, we were saying this thing the representation of the corresponding Lie algebra vanishes. So this term is absent. It transforms in the fundamental representation of SU2. So we were saying the generators for that are 1/2 times the Pauli sigma matrices. We'll write that in a minute. And then here we were saying that what we want is the appropriate representation of the hypercharge here, which I should have written again. In our normal U1 conventions, we explicitly include that. We pull that out of B mu. So this guy will become partial mu plus I G2 over 2 times the ith gauge boson W mu times the ith Pauli sigma matrix, because sigma I over 2 is the generator for SU2. And then in this case, this will be I, as we said over there, Y represented on this is just 1/2 times the identity matrix. So this will just be I over 2 times G1 times B mu. Let me pull the 1 over 2 out. And then times this guy. Okay, so let's continue to expand here. So, okay, this will be 1 over root 2 times, well, when we act with partial, it will kill the V, because that's just a constant, and we'll only get the partial acting on the new field, capital H. Capital H, by the way, I don't know if I've said this already, maybe I have, but little h is what I call the Higgs doublet, to emphasize it's the guy with two components. Capital H, which is just a single real scalar field, is what is usually called the Higgs boson. So unless I make a mistake, I'll try to stick to that language. So what we just get here is partial mu acting on the Higgs boson H, capital H. Okay, then we have these two guys. Well, we can write this out, this matrix out more explicitly as follows. So we have I over 2, and then from this guy, we get G1 times B mu in the upper and lower diagonals. And then from here, we get G2. If we think of the sigma 3, it contributes a plus and a minus. So we get plus G2 W mu 3 in the upper diagonal, and minus G2 times W mu 3 in the lower diagonal. And then from sigma 1 and sigma 2, we get G2 times W mu 1 minus W mu 2 in the upper off diagonal, and the complex conjugate down here, G2 times W mu 1 plus I W mu 2. Okay, and then that's all multiplied still by this vector. So now, again, we're trying, just like in the previous lecture, we're trying to just get the quadratic part of the Lagrangian. Right now, we're not trying to write down all the interaction vertices. We'll talk about those a little bit later, but we're trying to just get the terms with no more than two fields in them, two powers of fields in them, so that we can analyze what are the particles present and what are their masses. So, because these terms all involve fields already, you know, when we hit those with a constant, That will give us a term that's linear in the fields. When we hit it with H, we'll get terms that are quadratic in fields. But then we're going to square this whole thing to get the kinetic term. So those will all contribute higher than quadratic terms. Those will only contribute to the higher than quadratic terms. So in other words, for our purposes now, we can ignore the plus H here, and just because those will just give interaction terms. So this becomes 1 over root 2 plus IV over 2 times the right column here. Okay, so that's what the covariant derivative, and then this is plus quadratic terms, plus other terms we're ignoring. Again, coming from this. Okay, so now we want to square this. Well, what do we get when we square it? So when we take minus d mu h squared, minus d mu dagger d mu h, in other words, well, so now this is a two-component vector. We've taken its dagger, and we're hitting it with another two-component vector. So we'll get the absolute value squared of the upper components, because the upper component here will hit the upper the complex conjugate of the upper component here. So the square of that will give v squared over 4 times g2. Oh, sorry. So we have minus and then this thing, this whole thing squared. So let me pull that out front before I screw it up. Okay, so fine. So squaring the top component, we'll get plus I and minus I will give 1 times v squared over 4, this thing squared. And then this thing times its complex conjugate. So that will give g2 squared. And then this guy times its complex conjugate, the cross terms will cancel. And so we'll just get w mu 1 squared plus w mu 2 squared. Okay, and now, so now let's square the lower component of this two-component vector. Well, again, it's a real part plus I times an imaginary part. And so what we'll get is the real part squared, because this guy is going to be multiplied by its complex conjugate. So again, the cross terms will cancel. So we'll get the real guy squared. That's just the kinetic term for the Higgs. And then the imaginary part squared. So that'll be v squared over 4 times this whole thing, which is real, squared. Honestly, the poem is continuing to grow on me as I go through the lecture. Okay, great. So now, what do we have? Everything else we've really done already. So, okay, there's nothing to change on this line. These guys we expanded last time. I mean, just to remind, the answer is literally exactly symbol for symbol identical to what we wrote down last time. You know, so this part, when we plug in that expansion for H, will just become and we only keep terms up to quadratic order. That, remember, what we got was we got a constant term, a negative energy, an overall negative constant energy density, because we're sitting at the bottom of the potential, which is below zero. And that was given, so that in the Lagrangian, that was a contribution like plus m to the fourth over lambda. And then we got a mass term for the scalar field that fluctuates us in the radial direction in the potential, which in this case is capital H. And that looked like minus m squared times h squared, and then there were interaction terms. Okay, that's what the, that's what those potential terms become. So what do we have? And then now to that, we add this. Okay, so maybe I should, in fact, let me put them together on a board, or else it'll be confusing.
The end to the left.
Yes, thank you very much. Yes, there is. Indeed, this is squared, right? In fact, I mean, in general, you know, there should never be any linear terms appearing in the Lagrangian when you expand it around the vacuum, because if there were, you wouldn't have found the right vacuum. In other words, there would be some slope to the Lagrangian at that point, and you could move somewhere with advantage. Okay. Okay. So sorry. I think just for the sake of clarity, I should just take a moment to collect the terms we need here. So we have the kinetic terms for the bosons. We have, from the second line, well, again, we have the kinetic term for the scalar field, d mu h, from there. And we have the potential terms from last time. And then we just have to add all the other stuff up there, which are all quadratic terms that are involve two vector bosons. Okay, so let's look at those. So those go up on the vector line here. Well, one thing we got is, so we have minus a half, and then times v times g2 over 2 all squared times w mu 1 squared plus w mu 2 squared. And then we have that one other term, v squared over 4 times g1 b mu minus g2 w mu 3 all squared. Okay, now let me remind you, or tell you, that so for a vector field, a massless vector field, like we've said many times, has that as its Lagrangian. A massive vector field with mass mu has an extra term, which is 1 half mu squared times a squared. Okay, so, well, what do we have here? So for the g mu's, we have eight terms just like this, and no corresponding mass terms. So we see that indeed, the eight g mu a's are massless. Okay, those are called the eight gluon fields. Now, w mu, here we have w mu nu 1 squared, and then we have minus something times w mu 1 squared. So the field, in other words, we have a Lagrangian just like this for w mu 1, and for mu, we have exactly v times g2 over 2. So w mu 1 becomes a massive vector boson with mass mu v times g2 over 2. And the same with w2. W2, we have its kinetic term here, we have its mass term here, and its mass is exactly the same as it was for w1. So two of the real gauge bosons, w mu 1 and w mu 2, become our massive gauge bosons with mass m sub w is equal to g2 times the vev v over 2. Okay. And now we'll see this in a bit, but so it's usual to, once you break spontaneous symmetry, instead of thinking of these as two different gauge bosons, which two different real gauge bosons, which have two different real vector bosons, I no longer should call them gauge bosons because the gauge symmetry is broken here. They don't transform like gauge bosons. But they're two, instead of thinking of those two real vector bosons, we usually combine these guys because they have the same mass and will transform under electric charge. We combine them into the W plus and W minus gauge bosons. We combine them into a complex gauge boson defined by 1 over root 2. So W mu plus minus is defined to be 1 over root 2 W mu 1, and then plus or minus I W mu 2. So anyway, we get one complex or two real massive vector bosons with this mass. And then finally, what happens to B, the only two guys we haven't dealt with so far are B mu and W mu 3. The issue there is that their Lagrangian is not yet in this form. It's not yet in this form where it's just the kinetic term for a gauge field plus mu squared times that gauge field squared. So we're not yet ready to read off the mass. But this is something that happens again and again in QFT. And what are we supposed to do at this point? We're supposed to diagonalize the kinetic term. So let me just get a different board to do that on. No? Okay, so notice that we can write that term like, well, the kinetic terms for those two guys are 1/4 W mu nu 3 squared minus 1/4 D mu nu squared. And then the mass term, well, we want to diagonalize it. So the first thing is to write it in the form of a matrix that we can diagonalize. So let's write the mass term like, you know, we want to get it ultimately in the form 1/2 mu squared times gauge field squared. So for right now, we're going to write it like that, but in matrix form. So we have W mu nu 3 and B mu as a row vector acting on some 2x2 matrix, the mass squared matrix, and then times a column vector, W mu nu 3 B mu, where what is this matrix? Well, if you just multiply that thing out, expand out that expression and compare it to what the matrix M squared would have to be here, you'll see that M squared is, well, we have our V squared over 4. And then the upper diagonal component of this should be the other thing multiplying W mu, W mu. So that will be G2 squared. The lower diagonal component should be the coefficient of B mu times B mu up there, which will be G1 squared. And then the off diagonal terms, we want this to be a symmetric matrix so we can diagonalize it. So if we look at the terms, you know, we'll get minus G1 times G2 times B mu times W mu 3 when we expand that thing out. And then we'll get two copies of that from the two different cross terms. And we want to evenly split those two between here and here to make it a symmetric matrix that we can diagonalize. So this is minus G1, G2 down here, and minus G1, G2 up here. Okay, so now here I won't do this on the board, but I'll leave this as an exercise for either the tutorial or the homework, I think. But so we will diagonalize this. This is a symmetric matrix, so we can always write it as O transpose times a diagonal 2x2 matrix M hat squared times an orthogonal matrix again, and where one can check that the diagonal matrix here is has v squared over 4 times g1 squared plus g2 squared in the upper diagonal and 0 in the lower diagonal, okay, 0 in the off diagonals. And the orthogonal matrix, well, any orthogonal matrix we know can be written as any orthogonal 2 by 2 matrix can be written as cosine theta minus sine theta, cosine theta. But here we will get an explicit expression for cosine theta and sine theta when we diagonalize this matrix. And so this is not just any old theta. This is an important theta in the standard model. This is called the Weinberg angle, theta w. And you will find when you do this diagonalization that that sine theta w and cosine theta w are given by these famous expressions. Sine theta w is equal to g1 over the square root of g1 squared plus g2 squared. Cosine theta w is equal to g2 times the square root of g1 squared plus g2 squared. So in other words, this is, if we draw the g1, g2 plane here, then theta w is this. If this is the actual value of g1, of g2, comma g1 in the standard model, theta w is this angle here. And meanwhile, the square root of this is the, you see, now what we can do, we've taken m. I want to erase my picture of G2. I want to use the space for something else, sorry. So now we have expanded. Suppose we take this expression for m squared, plug it in there, and then redefine these fields by this orthogonal transformation. So then we can rewrite this thing. We can rewrite this term as minus 1 half, we'll call it z mu and a mu, where this is the z boson and the photon, times the diagonal matrix m hat times z mu a mu, where all we've done is defined, you know, we pulled off the orthogonal matrix on each side here and put it onto here. So in other words, z mu, we've made a change of variables where we just have defined the new variables z mu and a mu to be equal to that orthogonal matrix O times our earlier variables w mu 3 and a mu. And then because this is an orthogonal matrix, you can check that it does nothing to this to these terms. So it'll if we just do the same field transformation here, all that'll happen is that this will just change to z mu nu squared minus 1 fourth a mu nu squared, or what we usually call f mu nu, but I'm just calling it a mu nu squared for notational consistency. In other words, just to be clear, z mu, as always, z mu nu, I'm just defining to be partial mu z nu minus partial nu z mu, and same, the analogous expression for a mu nu, which is aka f mu nu. Okay, but so now if we look at this, well, now this is, now both of these, now z and a do both have separate Lagrangians, which have exactly that form up there at the top, and so we can read off that the mass of the z boson is the square root of this thing. v over 2 times the square root of g1 squared times g2 plus g2 squared, whereas the mass of the photon, m sub a, is 0. Okay, so there you go. That's what we have at the end of the day. We have this completes the description of how spontaneous symmetry breaking works in the bosonic part of the standard model. You see that it has indeed ended up the way we thought, that three of the gauge bosons have become massive. The other 8 plus 1 have remained massless. And the new, that we had to do this important thing, which is that we switched from we switched from these two vector fields as part of the spontaneous symmetry process and diagonalizing the Lagrangian to put it in terms of the mass eigenstates. We had to switch from these fields, which were the ones in terms of which the symmetric Lagrangian was most elegantly written, to these fields, which are the actual things that propagate with a well-defined mass as particles in the low-energy universe. And then in addition to those gauge bosons, we said we just had one of the, in the original Lagrangian, it looked like we had four real scalar fields, because we had started with a two-component vector with two complex numbers in it. But at the end of the day, physically, there's just one real scalar field in the low-energy Lagrangian. There you have it. If you take the ratio here of mz over, if you take the ratio of mw over mz, you'll see from this prediction the v over 2s drop out, and you just get the ratio of g2 over g1 squared plus g2 squared. So that's nothing but the cosine of the Weinberg angle, cosine of the Weinberg angle. But then that's also, these masses are both measured, were both measured in the early 80s with colliders. And so this is like 82 GeV over 91 GeV. So that's an example of how one of the parameters in the standard model is measured based on this prediction. Okay, so anyway, I should probably stop there. And then next time I'll explain the last bit of the spontaneous breaking, which is what it does to the fermions and their interpretation, and that's another interesting thing. Okay, any questions about that? All right.